Good afternoon. Richard Cross from Cross & Simon. May it please the court, and let me introduce Dave Holmes from my firm as well. Mr. Holmes assisted me at trial and with the appeal in this matter. Your Honor, we represent the appellants in this matter, Soterian Corporation, Robert Jones, or Bob Jones, and his son Scott Jones. This case presents two issues for the court. One issue is whether the trial court abused its discretion in finding an exception to the American rule and awarding defendant their attorney fees and expenses as relates to just defending themselves in the first 16 weeks of the case from the complaint. And second, did the trial court abuse its discretion in determining the amount of the attorney fees and expenses that were awarded? With respect to the first issue on the American rule, my clients contend it was an abuse of discretion to find the bad faith exception applied and award attorney fees in this case. In the court's opinion, in the trial court's opinion, the court said that by filing a lawsuit, the core allegations of which my clients knew to be false at the time they filed it, the Joneses and Soterian behaved in a manner that exemplifies the sort of bad faith conduct deserving of an award of attorney fees. So the court's decision on the attorney fees portion related to the facts that were asserted in the complaint that was filed. The complaint itself, and this is laid out in the facts, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail of the facts from the briefs, but the complaint at its core, we contend, sought to ensure that the defendants employed a proper process and acted appropriately in a divestiture strategy that was the company was undergoing. And what happened in this case was there was a draft complaint that was created in November of 2010. That draft complaint contained allegations that the company was selling assets, even though they didn't have a majority interest in those assets, that the company was excluding Margaret Jones, who was the wife of appellant Bob Jones and the mother of appellant Scott Jones, that they were excluding Margaret Jones from fully participating in board meetings. She was the board member that was a representative of the common unit holders, which was essentially the Jones family. There was an allegation that the board was failing to get proper, or the company was failing to get proper board authority for the approval of sales, and that the company was engaging in a plan to disperse proceeds from those sales in an improper manner. Now, when that draft complaint was prepared back in presumably late October of 2011, it's our contention those facts were true. The board had not approved the sale of a site that they were aware was under contract or was under a letter of intent. The board was attempting to sell those assets, even though there was a separate litigation pending at the time called the Juju litigation, in which another party contended that they had an interest in some of those assets.
Well, is the test for determining whether those facts alleged in the complaint were true or not one that there was reason to believe they were true, or is it you ultimately have to establish that they were fact, in other words, true?
No, well, you certainly don't have to. I don't believe that you have to establish all of the facts as being true in order to avoid a shifting of fees under the American rule, because people lose a trial all the time, and it doesn't always result in shifting of fees. I think you do have to have a good faith basis for the complaint when you file it.
And what you were just telling us about was the draft complaint, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. So there was a draft complaint prepared in 2010.
All right. So when the actual complaint was filed, was everything in the actual complaint true?
No, Your Honor. There was an allegation in the actual complaint that there had been no board meeting to approve the sale of what was called the LifeScan facility. However,
and your clients knew that was not true when they filed the complaint.
Yes, Your Honor, that they had participated in the board meeting at that time. However, the core allegation is that the appellees, the defendants, had engaged in a process which was being unfair to the Joneses. And what was determined, and in fact a fact that only came out at trial, was that the company and that the board were engaged in, for example, a secret meeting of the board to where they excluded Margaret Jones from the meeting, where they discussed the divestiture process. This is in August of that year, prior to the draft complaint being prepared, that the company had had a secret meeting, the board had a secret meeting, they discussed the divestiture process, they met with the company that had been hired to help with the divestiture process to get updates about that. And so,
but I suppose you're telling us this to justify filing a false complaint.
Well, I think what I'm saying is I think it distinguishes this case from those cases that I have seen where the court finds that a shifting of the fees is appropriate. In the cases that you see where a fee shifting is warranted, for example, in the Beck versus Atlantic Coast case, the plaintiff claimed that he had purchased a software product, that he was a naive computer user, and that he had been duped in after buying this software product, that it was, you know, trying to sell him something else. In fact, he was a sophisticated software engineer who had never even purchased the product, and he was trying to bring a class action claiming to be something that he wasn't. And in that,
well, Mr. Cross, I mean, there's really, it may be a bit myopic just to focus on the time when the complaint was filed. As I read the opinion of the trial court, there was a bad faith course of conduct before the complaint was filed, in that a draft complaint, which, you know, contained allegations that later turned out to be false, was sent to the counterparties of the proposed disposition of assets, not out of any intent to use the processes of the court to obtain any relief, but simply to block this deal from happening. And as I read the opinion of the court, that constituted an intentional interference with contractual expectations and would have been actionable but for the happenstance because of the declining fortunes of the company, the counterparties would not have gone through with the deals anyway. So you've got pre-litigation conduct that, to put it mildly, is not stellar, added to the fact that at the time the litigation was commenced, the complaint contained false core allegations that were never deleted from the complaint. So is this the best use of your time, arguing this point, or would it be to argue that the court erred by awarding too much in the way of attorney's fees?
Well, and I do want to argue the issue about the amount of the fees, but let me say that the trial court did find that the actions of the appellees, the actions of the defendants in this case, in meeting in secret back in August of 2010, did increase Margaret Jones's sense of alienation. This is the trial court's from the trial court's opinion. It increased Margaret Jones's sense of alienation from the rest of the board, made her suspicious that other managers were withholding important information from her, particularly information regarding the divestiture strategy. So, in other words, what the court ultimately found was that the defendants were acting in a way that was creating suspicion and raising the belief that they were withholding important information regarding the divestiture strategy. It did turn out at trial.
We're trying to understand your abuse of discretion argument, and based on what you just said, it appears to be, yes, we filed a false complaint and we knew it was false when we filed it, but as the trial unfolded, we learned some bad things about the other side. Therefore, it was an abuse of discretion to make us pay the other side's attorney's fees, notwithstanding the fact that we filed a false complaint, because we know the other side had some problems too.
Well, I would say it a little differently, Your Honor, because the Margaret Jones in August of 2010 was suspicious that there was a secret meeting. The defendants didn't admit that there was a secret meeting. She claimed that she believed there was a secret meeting at that time. And it was only at trial that the defendants admitted on the stand that a secret meeting took place and that they received that update. So I think our point, Your Honor, is that they were highly suspicious. They were trying to protect their interests.
Well, I understand that, but I'm, again, trying to just state your arguments so you'll have time to get to your other argument. It seems to be your client didn't cover themselves with glory, and neither did the other side. And therefore, when we have two people in litigation with foibles, they ought to each pay their own attorney.
I think that's right, Your Honor.
The trial judge said that your clients knew that the central allegations of the complaint were false. That's a factual finding, isn't it?
Well, I think the complaint is an exhibit that the court can review. This court can review. I think when you look at the complaint itself, I don't believe that that is the central core of the case. I think the central core is that my clients were trying to protect their rights and to ensure that a fair process was playing out on the divestiture strategy.
Is it your position that that statement from the trial court was clearly wrong?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that would be a fair statement. I think that's an incorrect statement. I think it's lifted from the appellee's brief. It was lifted from their post-trial brief. And I don't think that when you look at the complaint that was filed, that it is the central core of the complaint. I think the core of the complaint was to try to protect their interests. And if you look at that LeCrenier decision that was cited in the briefs here, the court said that although the plaintiff failed to undertake an analysis, and if they had, they would have realized that they didn't have a case to bring, they didn't shift fees in that case because they were trying to protect their legal rights and were just misguided. And I think that's closer to the situation we have here. It's not a case where my clients continued to act in a way during the course of litigation where they, for example, failed to produce documents or lied under oath or did any of the things that you see that sort of continuous conduct that warrants a shifting of fees. With respect to the issue of the amount of the attorney fees and expenses awarded, my clients contend that it was an abuse of discretion in determining the amount that was awarded. In this case, the court only awarded fees related to that were the defendant's attorney's fees related to defense of the initial complaint. The complaint itself was filed in February of 2011, and it was dismissed in late May 2011. There's a little bit of a discrepancy, but the order goes through May 24 of 2011 for the award of fees. That's a period of about 16 weeks. The defendants claimed attorney fees and expenses of a little over $842,000 for that 16-week period. Now, the court did not award the defendants their attorney fees and expenses that were attributable to bringing the counterclaim. However, the defendants only attributed during that same 16-week period a little over $28,000 to bringing the counterclaim. The issue is, however, that in May of 2011, which was in May 19 of 2011, which was just before the complaint was dismissed, the defendants stated to the court, for example, that they had conducted 90% of the discovery they needed on the counterclaim and that they were ready to go to trial the following week on their counterclaims. However, when the defendants then submitted their fees and expenses to the trial court, they only attributed, as I said, $28,000 to the counterclaim and none of their time to discovery on the counterclaim.
I thought that was answered, or at least an answer was attempted by the opposing counsel along the lines of all of the facts involved in this matter were overlapping or even essentially the same. So to say that you're 90% ready to go forward with your counterclaim doesn't mean that you've been devoting a lot of separate time to the counterclaim.
Well, and I think they do. I agree that I think that that's the argument that they try to make, which is that they can't parse it out. But the case that the defendants, the appellees, rely on, there's two cases, really. The Hensley versus Eckerhart, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case, and the Matera versus Bloom case, which is an Eastern District of Pennsylvania case. And they cite those cases for the proposition that if allocating between successful and unsuccessful claims and where they can't be easily allocated, they should get their full fee. First of all, the decision in those cases actually says that where the general results of the litigation are, quote, excellent, and where there are successful and unsuccessful claims and you can't allocate, then you may be entitled to your full compensatory fee. But you have to first have excellent results in the litigation. In this case, the defendants sought nearly $4 million. It was $3.99 million in damages at trial.
Well, wait a second. Aren't we getting confused here? Or at least I'm getting confused here. I thought the award of attorney's fees related to the first 16 weeks before your clients agreed to have their claims dismissed, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And then more time went by, and there was a trial on the counterclaims, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're saying, well, that was not a successful venture on the counterclaims. Therefore, the rule having to do with getting a wonderful result doesn't apply here. But we're not talking about the counterclaims. We're talking about the time period while your complaint was what was on the table. So what difference does that make, number one? And number two, in terms of the amount of the fees, am I correct that this amount represented less than half of the total fees if you included the time period for the prosecution of the counterclaim?
Well, there's a lot of questions there, so let me see if I hope I answer them all. The issue is that during that 16-week period, from February until May, they not only defended themselves from the complaint, they also prepared and filed counterclaims. They also prepared and served discovery, and they represented to the court in May, just within that 16-week period, that they had already conducted 90% of the discovery they needed for the counterclaim and were prepared to go to trial that next week in May of 2011. Now, the case did get delayed, but they had represented to the court in May of 2011 that during that 16-week period, they had answered they had prepared a counterclaim, they had prepared discovery related to it, and they had almost all of the discovery they needed and were prepared to go to trial. So in what the trial court had said was, look at that 16-week period and you only get your fees that are attributable to defense of the complaint. You don't get your fees attributable
right,
to pursuing.
Right, but now we're just circling around. But you were arguing, if I haven't lost the thread by now, that the reason why this fee award is inappropriate is because the parties did not achieve an excellent result. And you're turning to the counterclaim and saying, see, that was not an excellent result on their behalf. But that's not what we're talking about, is it? Aren't we talking about your complaint that the result of that was it was dismissed? I don't know how you can get a better result than that.
Right. As I read the Hensley versus Eckerhart case, and as I read the Matera versus Bloom case, which are the two cases that talk about a situation where you have successful and unsuccessful claims and whether you can parse those fees up. The initial inquiry is whether the overall case resulted in an excellent result for the party seeking their fees. In this case, our position is it certainly was not. In the Matera case, for example, Matera sought their attorney fees because they were successful on some of their claims. They said they couldn't parse some of those claims. The trial court said you received some of the money you were seeking after a trial, but not all of it, and so it was a good result, not an excellent result. What we're saying is if you look at this overall case, the defendants were seeking nearly $4 million in damages, and they didn't just get less than that, they lost on that. And so the outcome for them overall, in our view, is not excellent. And therefore, you can't just say, well, you'll get, you know, you don't have to worry about parsing out your fees. If you look at that Hensley, in the Hensley versus Eckerhart case, what the Supreme Court said was that it's the counsel for the applicant, or it's the applicant who bears the burden of establishing the entitlement and documenting the hours. And it's the applicant who should maintain billing time records in a manner that will enable them to identify the distinct claims to the reviewing court. So in this case, what we have is a situation where there's these time records that they say they can't parse out. But what we point out, for Your Honor, and is that it's not just that we think they didn't parse it in a fair way. There's express entries in their time records where they say they're working on the counterclaim. They didn't parse those out. So we already know that they didn't go through those time records and parse out the ones that expressly say that they were working on the counterclaim. Furthermore,
was that raised before the trial court?
Yes, Your Honor, it was.
And the trial court said in response?
It was a sufficient attempt by them to parse it out. But as we pointed out, I mean, there's entries, and we put this in our briefs, as well. There are example entries that say, quote, work on counterclaim, close quote. That got lumped into fees that they were awarded for defending themselves in the complaint. There was one draft counterclaim on February 23, 2011.
So have you quantified everything that you'd like to deduct?
No, because most of the time they don't do what the Hensley court says. They don't actually distinguish for most of the work that they do whether it's relating to the counterclaim or it's relating to the complaint. And it's our position that if the outcome isn't, first of all, the Hensley case and the Matera case are fee shifting under a statute, not fee shifting due to the American rule. So to the extent that applies, they have an obligation under that Hensley decision if it's applied, you know, somewhat of authority, it still requires the applicant to maintain billing records in a manner that it can be done.
Take a position before the trial court that only X dollars should be awarded, if any are awarded?
We did not set a dollar amount. It was our position that it was clearly more than it should have been because of the disparity between what was attributed to the complaint and what was attributed to the counterclaim.
Did you want to save your last minute for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I think I'd reserve five, but
I've
talked through that. I'll reserve the last minute then. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Chief Justice, fellow justices of the court, may it please the court. My name is Daniel Toby. I'm here today on behalf of appellees. This is my first appearance before this court, and it is an honor and a privilege to be here. This is a very important case, Your Honors, because it has to do with protecting the integrity of the legal system. And appellants today bear a heavy burden, which is to prove that there was an abuse of discretion by Vice Chancellor Noble as to two things: both the award of attorney's fees under the bad faith exception to the American rule, and as to the amount and segregation of fees. And in both cases, Your Honors, they cannot meet that burden. On the first issue, Your Honor, The case law is clear that there's no one set standard for what constitutes bad faith. As the justices have written in recent opinions, such as Dover, there are many examples. Filing a false or misleading claim, using litigation to delay the achievement of rights, unnecessarily prolonging litigation, changing positions on issues, and using litigation to obtain a settlement without an intent to bring it to full adjudication. What's interesting about this, Your Honor, is in the cases I'm referring to, Dover, Arbitrium, several other cases, any one of those are disjunctive examples, any one of those has been found to constitute bad faith. In this case, we actually have all of those indicia of bad faith. For example, the initial draft complaint that was sent, the trial court made a fact-bound, very specific decision. It said, setting aside for the moment whether or not the allegations were known to be false at the time of sending that draft complaint to a potential buyer, it was an improper act of interference. And the trial court found, as a matter of fact, that appellants never had any indication of bringing those claims to full adjudication. That was a bad faith litigation conduct outside of and pre-litigation, just as in the Dover case. Then, after appellants attended a meeting where they discussed the sale of two facilities, the board voted with a quorum present, and the sales were authorized, they verified a complaint 2 weeks later that said the exact opposite, that the board had never authorized a sale, and that the board was acting without authority and trying to pursue, and that the managers were acting without authority trying to pursue that sale. What's more, Your Honors, when the appellants were finally deposed, they admitted that those facts were false when verified, and that they knew those facts were false when verified. We received two different explanations for that conduct. The first from Robert Jones was that he failed to read the complaint when he verified it, despite verifying in the first line of his verification that he had read the pleading before him and all of it was true to the best of his knowledge. Scott Jones gave a different explanation. He said, yes, I'm sure I would have read that, and yes, I knew that those statements were false at the time. I guess it was an oversight. The court found that to be a second indicia of bad faith. Third, after another board meeting in January, where two more facilities were voted on by the board with a quorum present, with Margaret Jones present, they filed the verified complaint, making the same core allegations that the board was acting without authority, that it never authorized the sale of any facilities, and that the issue had not even been raised, despite the fact that the record is indisputable that the issue of selling the facilities had not only been voted on twice in the last month, but had been discussed and authorized for a period of the last year beforehand. Then, after they file the verified false complaint, the Joneses essentially disappear from the litigation, and that's yet another indicia of bad faith. The court said, in its words, that they essentially disappeared from the case. They didn't answer the counterclaim filed against them. They didn't respond to discovery. To date, they have never responded to their interrogatories. They only appeared at their depositions by order of the court, and they only even answered the counterclaims by order of the court. Morris Nichols, the original Delaware firm representing appellants, actually dropped out of the case, withdrew for that exact reason, that they could not get cooperation from their clients or their Texas counsel.
As I understand, the other side, part of their argument is the vice chancellor's conclusion that they knew that the central allegations of the complaint were false was clearly wrong, focusing on central allegations. Why is that not the case?
That's an excellent question, Your Honor. There's a few answers. The first is, as a factual matter, those are the core allegations. We've heard a fair amount today about a secret meeting, and it's indisputable in the record that there was a meeting once the board members found out that the Joneses were going to file a lawsuit. They met in advance of a board meeting in order to talk about how do we deal with this problem of a board member who is working with prospective plaintiffs who are going to sue us. Whether or not in hindsight that was the best idea, it does not go to the question of what Vice Chancellor Noble found. Vice Chancellor Noble made a factual determination that there was, quote, a secret meeting. But what's key here is there is nothing in the plaintiff's complaint that talks about secret meetings. In fact, what they explicitly say in the petition at paragraph 24 is, despite threats that Margaret Jones would not be able to attend, plaintiff's managers, which is Margaret Jones, have attended every single official board meeting. Now, that's actually a true fact, and in fact, it may be one of the most true facts in the complaint, is that for all official board meetings where there was board business, there were votes taken, Margaret Jones was present. What that shows, Your Honor, is when they verified this complaint, the core allegations of which were false, this idea of the secret meeting was not even pled in the petition. In fact, they pled the exact opposite, that she had attended every meeting. So Your Honor raised a very good point, which is if you find out later a fact in the litigation, does that go back and justify a false complaint? The answer is no, Your Honor. Of course, I think that's where Your Honor was leading. But there's no question that the core allegation of this complaint is that the sales were taken without authority. And I just have the complaint right here. I can read a few examples. Moreover, defendants are engaging in sales without authority and in violation of the LLC agreement. No sale of any imaging center has been raised or voted on at any board of managers meeting. No valid delegation of authority to execute a plan to sell any imaging center has been voted on in any board of managers meeting. No transaction as described above has ever been raised or voted on in a meeting. It goes on and on, Your Honors, and I won't belabor the point because it's all on the record for you, but there's no question that the core allegation, and in fact the only allegation that's really material here, is that the board was quote-unquote acting without authority. And we know that that's false because, as the appellants have already admitted, they were there at the very board meeting where these actions were voted on, and they verified the false complaint 2 weeks after that with full knowledge of the falsity. Now, the second point to your question, Your Honor, is let's suppose that that was not the core allegation. I submit respectfully that it is, and that the post hoc argument that we're getting now about a secret board meeting was not even in the petition when verified. But suppose it weren't true. Suppose there were several claims. You go through and you see all this stuff about authority, and suppose there was a paragraph about a secret meeting. The question remains, is this like a motion to dismiss where if there's one true theory in the middle of a vast amount of false theories and knowingly false theories, does that save the petition? Or is it sufficient for bad faith conduct to say 9 out of 10 statements in this petition were patently false and known to be false when verified? Just because they can point to one hypothetical contention that ended up being true, and again, this is hypothetical, it's not in the petition, but even if they could point to one true thing, that would not excuse the bad faith conduct of filing a petition that, in the court's words, not ours, was laden with falsities. It's a factual determination, and it's apparent on the record. I just want to give a little bit of factual background on the dispute so that I can talk about the size of the fees and the segregation of the fees. And of course, I won't answer any question, but I'll segue now away from the bad faith conduct justifying the shifting of fees towards the size and segregation, since I heard the court asking those questions of appellants. The award of $850,000 or so in fees is large, but absolutely reasonable in light of the factual situation. So as Your Honors know, and I'll speak in broad strokes because it's laid out in the briefing and in the Vice Chancellor's opinion very clearly, but this was a live-or-die situation for the company Soteria. They had a senior debt that was coming due in November of 2010. They were already in covenant default. The metrics were bad. They knew they were going to have trouble meeting their, what would, when it became mature, be $20 million in senior debt due. The consequences of a payment default would have been catastrophic for Soteria and its investors. Carousel, the private equity firm, invested $17 million in this venture when they purchased it from the Joneses. They paid the Joneses $17 million in cash plus a couple million dollars in subordinate seller's notes, and they put a $17.5 million investment into the company. Now, after 2004, when they bought the company, the projections for the next year's revenues came in about half of what was purported in the sales materials, and it got worse from there. The market for medical imaging equipment was not doing well. So they were in covenant default as of September 2009, and by March 2010, they had spoken to their senior lender and found out that they would not get an extension of that maturation date. So the clock was ticking. What would have happened if they were in payment default? It would have been foreclosure. It would have been possibly bankruptcy to prevent foreclosure. They would have essentially liquidated at fire sale prices, and they would have lost a substantial $17 million cash investment. So this was do or die for the company. So what did they do? They acted, I would submit, very reasonably. They brought in five investment banks to give proposals. They ended up retaining the precise investment bank that Margaret Jones preferred and recommended, which was Brookwood. And what Brookwood and then RCA, another company that was brought in, recommended was a two-pronged approach: selective divestiture of certain assets, and then also considering a wholesale sale of the company. So essentially, to make a long story short, this was pursued, voted on, approved, reapproved over and over again. It's all in the record over this period of 2010. The Joneses had an ulterior motive, which the trial court alludes to, which is they preferred a wholesale sale of the company because in their belief that would trigger the payment of their notes. What they could not accomplish with their votes on the board, they decided to accomplish by sending this interfering petition to a potential buyer, which had the desired effect. Then the board went forward, had a meeting. Ms. Jones was present. Scott Jones was present. Even though he's not on the board, he was allowed to participate and talk. And the board voted twice to authorize these sales. So the board is doing the best that it can to forestall liquidation by their senior lender. The investment banks are on board. The lender is on board. The lender has said that it's not going to take catastrophic action as long as this divestiture is going on. They like what they're seeing. They want the note paid down by $10 million. It looks like that's going to happen. So what do the Joneses do? They file this complaint, this verified petition, with false claims in it, which they had no intention to bring to adjudication. And there were six claims at issue in this case. There were three claims by the Joneses and then three counterclaims brought by Soteria and Carousel. And those counterclaims were essentially, two were for injunctive and declaratory relief that were the reciprocal version of appellant's case. They said, we have authority, we've been acting pursuant to the LLC agreement, and we have a right to sell these facilities in order to let the process, the divestiture process, continue. So what was the outcome of this case? We requested expedition. We wanted 30 days. We got 90 days. And then appellants essentially disappeared. So what we had to do was prepare a bet the company litigation to prevent foreclosure, loss of a $17 million investment, in order to clear up our ability to continue divesting and avoid foreclosure. So to put the fees in context, in 3 months, we prepared for trial, which we ultimately prevailed on 5 out of 6 claims. The sixth claim was put towards a future trial, which, as Justice Berger correctly pointed out, is not part of the fee award. So we won 5 out of 5. I would say that is an excellent result. Interestingly enough, the way we won was after finally deposing the Scotts and the Joneses and getting them to admit to their verification of a false complaint. A couple days later, they made a settlement demand for $5.75 million, which goes to their motive in a second. And then after we summarily rejected that, they agreed to non-suit all their claims and agreed to judgment against them on 2 of the 3 counterclaims, leaving tortious interference for another day. So is it reasonable for a company who's about to lose their $17.5 million investment to spend $850,000 in a 3-month expedited trial that is literally bet the company litigation, in which they achieved a result of 5 out of 5 successful claims? I would submit the answer is yes. Now, the burden that they have to overcome is a tough one. It's, as you know, clear abuse of discretion. And they have to show not that this court disagrees with Vice Chancellor Noble's impressions, but that he acted capriciously and arbitrarily, essentially, the way the case law puts it, without reason or in good conscience. That is simply not the case here. This was a detailed, fact-bound decision. He looked at the timesheets which were submitted before the court. He looked at the scope of what was at stake for the company. He actually complimented later, when the trial took place, the efficiency with which counsel put on all of this case. It was truly about the company litigation. And going to the motive issue, it is somewhat surprising or disappointing that the Joneses would challenge an $850,000 expense in a bet the company litigation when their settlement demand was $5.75 million. That was their valuation of what was at risk to Soterion and Carousel in this case, and yet they are balking now at fees that they caused to be expended that are essentially less than 20% of their estimation of the amount in controversy. Obviously, the company had a lot more to lose with its $17 million investment, but even under their own statement of the facts, this was a less than 20% of amount in controversy effort, very reasonable. On to the segregation point, and there's a lot to say here. Vice Chancellor Noble, again, made a factual determination, and I think the way he wrote it was exactly right. He said there is no science to segregation of fees, but in his determination, looking at all the evidence before him, appellees made a reasonable and good effort to segregate the fees out. Now, I want to talk about some of their specific examples. They talk about having to get an excellent result, and that is language that is mentioned in some of the out-of-state jurisprudence that was mentioned in the briefing, but it's off point, and they're sort of latching on to the wrong legal principle here. That is what happens when there are both successful and unsuccessful claims, and you're asking the question, can you recover for the entire amount? That's not what happened here, as Justice Berger correctly pointed out. The tortious interference piece, which was the only unsuccessful claim, and let me just add that it was only barely unsuccessful, as the justices pointed out, the court found there was improper interference and tortious interference. The problem was one of causation. There were market forces which also contributed, and the court could not find for us on proximate cause. So even there, it was a validation of everything we had been saying, and circumstances outside of the control of any of the parties weighed in for causation. But I would submit first, this was an excellent result, because for the bracket of issues that were before the court and fees were awarded, we prevailed on 5 of 5 claims, and essentially did even better than that, because the appellants essentially non-suited or dismissed their own claims with prejudice and agreed to the affirmative relief we were seeking against them based on the record we were able to put together in an expedited 3-month period. So that's a good result. But it's the wrong legal standard, because we're not trying to recover for both successful and unsuccessful claims per se. The really relevant authority is the Textron case out of Delaware, which talks about what happens when you're trying to segregate and the claims arise from the same nexus of facts. And that's really the key issue here, is the same nexus of facts that supported defeating the affirmative claims by the Joneses and prevailing on the affirmative claims, first two counterclaims by Soteria and Carousel, it's the same nexus of facts that supported tortious interference. And to put it in a very broad strokes way, to defeat their claims, we had to show that their petition was frivolous, and that what it really was an attempt to interfere with ongoing sales that had been approved by the board. Now, to prevail on tortious interference, we had to show that their claims were frivolous, and the petition they used was essentially a ploy to defeat ongoing sales that had been approved by the board. So it's absolutely the same nexus of facts. And under Textron and other cases, we would have been entitled to recover for everything within that period, because there's really nothing distinguishable about those claims. But that's not what we did. Under the court's instruction, we did go through, and it's all in the record, and I won't belabor it, but there are attorney affidavit evidence talking about how the tortious interference claim at that initial bet the company 3-month expedited point was not the focus. Yes, we felt that we had damages. The diminution in value and the loss of those two sales was $5 million. The court found against us on that. We obviously haven't appealed it. We respect the court's decision on that. But the salient issue is, at that time, what was really important to Soteria and Carousel was to get rid of this litigation so that the sales could go forward. That was absolutely the important point. And so when there were statements made to the court about we're ready to go, it's 90% done, time was of the essence.
Well, so if I can try to encapsulize your argument as far as it concerns the abuse of discretion, that is the claim that the court awarded too much, it is that for the most part, the same facts that were necessary to mount your defense against the other side's affirmative claims were the same facts that would have supported the counterclaims for intentional interference. to the extent that there were facts that were not common to both, your clients did the best they could to carve out, the lawyer effort devoted to uncovering and preserving those facts.
That's exactly right, Your Honor, and the record supports that. In the appendix to our brief, to Appelli's brief, you'll see that there are, and it's actually in theirs as well, you'll see that there are attorney affidavits talking about how the vast majority of the work was duplicative across all the claims, or specifically for defeating plaintiff's claims and defending our first two counterclaims. But we also had each of the three firms, the two Delaware firms and then the Texas firm that has worked with Carousel, went through their timesheets, identified everything that was attributable to tortious interference, and segregated it out, made a chart that goes at the front of all of the timesheets, and it's all in the record, saying, for example, 6 hours, this is an approximation, I think it's more like eight, spent on researching tortious interference law in Delaware and drafting an insert for the complaint on tortious interference. So to the extent there were discrete pieces of the pre-May 24th work that were attributable to tortious interference, those absolutely were segregated out, Your Honor. You're correct. And I do want to correct one thing that I think is extremely important. It's in their briefing, and they also argued it here, which is that, well, but there's all these entries about counterclaims, and they didn't take out all the pieces of counterclaims. It's very important to clarify that point. There were three counterclaims, and the two that were essential were the declaratory and injunctive relief that would disabuse any potential buyer of these non-core assets that the board was acting without authority. And to highlight the importance of those, our side actually moved the court to bifurcate the trial. We said, let's take tortious interference down the line on this expedited schedule. Let's focus on what's really important right now on an emergency bet the company basis, which is letting these sales go through so the senior lender doesn't foreclose on the entire endeavor. So when they say, oh, look right here, it says work on counterclaims, the counterclaims were the two that were essentially reciprocal of defeating their claims. That was the lion's share of the effort. That testimony is in the record from Mr. Holmes, who was lead trial counsel, and others talking about that. Now, to the extent that they argue that this ratio, they talk about, I see my time is almost up, 96% to 3%, whatever it was, I find it interesting that not only did we undertake a diligent effort to go through and spend more time, more attorney money, fighting what we have considered a cause that never should have been brought in the first case to segregate out those fees. But if you actually look at the petition, there's about 90, our amended counterclaim. There are 90 paragraphs in that. Three of them have to do with tortious interference. One of those three simply incorporates all the preceding parts. And then the rest are basically a recitation of the elements. So this is perhaps a broad strokes argument, but even looking at the work product that was produced, it comes out to about the exact ratio that they're decrying. This split of 96 to 3 is exactly the amount of attention paid in the petition, in the complaint. So in conclusion, I think the conduct speaks for itself in this case and clearly falls within numerous indicia of bad faith conduct. The award was not an abuse of discretion. This was a fact-bound, very careful opinion. The court was careful to indulge every factual inference in favor of the Joneses, and yet still found, even in noting that this was a rare situation where you shift fees, he said this was undoubtedly the case. And he said even though the expenses were high, they were appropriate in light of a litigation that never should have been brought, that put the entire company at risk and $17.5 million of investment at risk. With that, I'll close, and I appreciate the court's time.
Thank you.
Very briefly, what I hear from Appelli is that they acknowledge that some of the time that they included in the fee application related to counterclaims, just not the tortious interference claim. But that is not what the court awarded them. The court only awarded them their fees related to defending themselves from the complaint. And in fact, as an example, they attributed 142 hours to answering the complaint, where they essentially answered it with deny, deny, or no response required. They only attributed 8.7 hours to drafting a 14-page counterclaim that contained three counts. They were not entitled to recover for that counterclaim any of the counts, not just the tortious interference one. With respect to the core allegations, I think paragraph one of the complaint sets out that the core allegation of this case was about protecting the interests of the plaintiffs in Centurion. And it's paragraphs 21 through 24 that lay out various factual allegations. Only paragraph 23 deals with not having approval from the board. So it's not that's not the core allegation.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and assess.
Ms. Ryan.